Good afternoon. I will call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotizo Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Here.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegard. Representative Lucero.
Happy afternoon.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Present.
Representative Haley.
Present.
Representative Lislegard.
A quorum is present. The first item of business is approval of our minutes from our last meeting. Representative Cotizo Watoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I would move the minutes from February 26th.
Any discussion to the Cotizo Watoon motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the minutes for February 26, 2021 are adopted. Members, we have four bills on the agenda today. Just as a heads up to committee members, I do have a bill up in another committee. So at some point, I will virtually pass the gavel to Representative Cotizo Watoon. And we will try and do that in a way that does not interrupt the flow of the committee. So you may just spontaneously see Carly's smiling face up here. So our first bill on the agenda is House File 79 by Representative Wasilewicz. Welcome to the committee, Representative. I will move that House File 79 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy. And with that, hand the floor to Representative Wasilewicz to describe her bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, some of you may be familiar with PFAS. It stands for perfluoroalkyl alkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances. And these chemicals are a group of man-made chemicals that are found in a wide range of products, including carpet, cookware, food packaging, et cetera. So this means that most people have been exposed to PFAS at some point in their life. The problem with these chemicals is that they are persistent in the environment and in the human body, meaning they don't break down and they can accumulate over time, causing adverse health effects such as low infant birth rates, cancer, and thyroid hormone disruptions. PFAS chemicals are often used in food packaging as water or grease-proofing agents. There was a handout in your packet that shows a little bit sort of the path that these chemicals can travel from the food packaging into the environment and into the human body. So just running through that a little bit, these chemicals often find their way from food packaging to the human body, either through direct contact with the food that they're touching and then people eat the food, or through the environment. So they might, food packaging materials might end up going to a landfill or a compost facility, and then they might come in contact with water, and then the leachate leaving those sites goes a number of places, but one of the places we're seeing it show up is in wastewater treatment facilities and in groundwater. And then from the groundwater, we've seen it get into drinking water supplies as well. So, and we've seen examples of PFAS contaminated drinking water in our state. Two examples that come to mind are the East Metro with the 3M issues of PFAS, and then in the city of Bemidji as well. So those are a couple of ways that PFAS gets from the food packaging to the human body. So House File 79 attempts to tackle these issues by banning the manufacture, distribution, and sale of food packaging that contains intentionally added PFAS beginning January 1st, 2023. The bill also requires the Department of Health to amend the Health Risk Limit, or HRL, for one of the PFAS chemicals known as perfluorooctane sulfonate, or PFAS, so that it does not exceed 0.015 parts per billion. This value is the same value as the current health-based value for this chemical that was established in 2020, and this health-based value was developed by scientists at the Department of Health. So that is the bill, and I know there are a few testifiers that are here to speak to the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Wasilick. I have one testifier that signed up with you, and that's Eileen Weber. So maybe we'll start with Ms. Weber. Ms. Weber. Ms. Weber, you are muted.
I thought I had that down. I'm sorry. Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of House File 79. I live in the Southeast Metro area affected by the plume of forever chemicals left in our area's groundwater by 3M's manufacturing processes decades ago. We drank, bathed, laundered, and cooked with Cottage Grove's contaminated water for 15 years. During that time, we were raising our family, and I was pregnant with our youngest child. Our kids now have grown, and we moved to property in the area with our own well and septic. While our water now tests negative for PFAS, though worrisomely positive for atrazine, I will now worry for the rest of my life if any future negative health problems in our family were caused or exacerbated by the exposure we had for 15 years in Cottage Grove. This is especially because some PFAS do build up in the body over time. And as my 64-year-old husband and I eagerly await our turn for a COVID-19 vaccine, the information from the MPCA website that PFAS can cause a reduced immunological response to vaccination worries us more than a little. I believe there is also an equity concern that supports you doing all you can against PFAS and explains why this bill has bipartisan support. There are pockets of poverty in the Southeast Metro where people don't have the means to move out of the flume. For example, in 2019, 12% of Newport residents had an income below the poverty level, which was significantly more than the poverty level of 9% across the entire state. Black people in Newport are those most likely to be in poverty, with over 38% of them below the poverty level. As with so many environmental health issues, our Black and Brown community members often unfairly suffer more. That injustice ends up costing all of us more to address. I'm also a public health nurse and nurse educator at the University of Minnesota, where we teach health professional students about the precautionary principle. When all we have is reasonable suspicion, the precautionary principle underscores the duty that those in charge of public health have to prevent harm, even if direct causation is initially unclear. It's the principle we uphold in the face of avoidable risk when we say, better safe than sorry. I believe that idea supports you doing all you can now to make us more safe and less sorry. That includes amending the relevant health risk limits and eliminating PFAS from food packaging, and I might add considering removing the intent loophole in Section 1, Subdivision 2 of the bill. Thank you for the work you do and for listening to my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Weber. We now will turn to public testifiers. The first public testifier on the list is Tony Quiles from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tony Quiles, and as the chair pointed out for the record, I am the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And thank you for allowing me, and I'll try to stay within the 2 minutes, Mr. Chairman, to get you going throughout the day. But I just thank you for allowing me to make a couple comments on House File 79. House File 79, Mr. Chairman, will be the most restrictive piece of legislation dealing with food packaging in the nation. You have seen in your packets there are letters referencing three other states, and I'll go through those in a second. But manufacturers of this product, Mr. Chairman, packaging products, don't make products just for Minnesota. They make them for nationally, if not internationally. So I would like to point that out before I start, Mr. Chairman. But those three other states that people have referenced in the handouts, in New York, they only do plant-based fibers, and they don't have a packaging component definition. Washington, that approved theirs in 2018, only does fiber-based products also, requires their equivalent of the Pollution Control Agency to do a safer alternatives assessment, evaluate those alternatives, and then follow the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse guidelines evaluating the performance, cost, and availability of those alternatives. They also put together a stakeholder group of people from their university, businesses, manufacturers, environmental organizations, state agencies to advise them as they move through the process. And then Maine passed theirs in 2019, but again, asked their PCA equivalent to identify safer alternatives that are readily available of sufficient quantity, comparable cost, and their bill only applies to manufacturers that have $1 billion and over in national sales. So I just wanted to point that out, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, when we regulate products in Minnesota, usually when we do what I call the manufacturer retail lag, we don't just have a hard stop date. There's a stop for manufacturer, then a sell through for retail, and then a stop date. So I wanted to point that out, Mr. Chairman, in regards to the effective date. I'm not going to go into Section 2 and what a dangerous precedent that sets. That's for a healthcare committee. And so I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to make my points.
Well, thank you, sir. And I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
Oh, no, you were close. It's been, you can imagine, Mr. Chairman. It's,
I don't think that's a lot of shoes or hand grenades. Our next testifier in the public is Jason Culotta of the Minnesota Food Products Association.
Well, thank you, Chair Stevenson. And members, appreciate the opportunity to comment. First, I'd like to thank Representative Wasluwick for entertaining an amendment that we had asked for at the Environment Committee to provide an additional year from what had originally been proposed as an effective date, which went from January of 2022 to January of 2023. And we had asked for that because while we have many products that have already moved packaging from PFAS materials to other substances, there still are food products that we have yet to prove a alternative for. And so while those are being sought out and those trials are being undertaken, our concern is that all of those packaging materials may not be available come January of 2023. And so we do believe that with a little bit of additional time, perhaps another year extension of that, that would allow the industry to be in compliance with this proposed legislation. So that's what we're here asking for today, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Doug Carnival from the National Solid Waste Management Association. Mr. Carnival. Mr. Carnival, you are muted.
There we go. How's that? Can you hear me, sir?
Better. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will stay within my 2 minutes as well, if I can. The Minnesota chapter of the National Waste and Recycling Association thanks you for the opportunity to provide comments on House File 79 related to PFAS and food packaging. NWRA represents landfills that are the receivers of food and food packaging and a variety of other type products that contain PFAS, just like wastewater treatment facilities. We're not the producers or generators of the products, but rather manage the products that we receive as waste at the end of their useful life. Our association supports an upstream approach that looks at the point of manufacture to get PFAS out of the products and packaging. In fact, we believe House File 79 needs to go further in looking at this upstream source of products as a source of PFAS in the environment, rather than an after-the-fact end-of-the-pipe monitoring program. Here's why. Several of the states have already developed their statewide PFAS plans. These state plans have a strong focus on products as the source of PFAS and in the environment. Many products with high concentrations of PFAS are already known and listed in some states' PFAS plans. We're concerned that MPCA's focus is on the end of the pipeline monitoring and that the true source of PFAS, the products and packages that end up in the waste stream, are not emphasized enough. We already know PFAS is in the environment. If Minnesota's emphasis is on monitoring and gathering data on PFAS in the environment, what really much further are we going to get? In general, a more preventive approach has included assistance to and incentives for manufacturers who get PFAS products out of the environment, and that's where we think you ought to go. Our second concern is that this legislation is without precedent across the nation, setting an arbitrary standard of 0.0115 parts per billion. No other state has a more stringent standard than we have here that you've proposed. And the economic burden of meeting this new standard will be unfairly borne by all solid waste facilities, wastewater treatment facilities, and others who are merely receivers of spent and used up products. Thank you very much for your testimony. We've submitted a more extensive set of comments in writing to you as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival. Finally, I have Sean Swearingen with the Alliance for Telomere Chemistry Stewardship. Would you like to introduce yourself and state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Vice Chair. My name is Sean Swearingen. I'm the director for the American Chemistry Council. I'm representing the Alliance for Telomere Chemistry Stewardship, ATCS. I'll try to stay within the 2 minutes today. ATCS is a global organization that advocates on behalf of C6 fluorotelomere-based products, our leading manufacturers of these products. We agree with the principle of the bill. We respectfully request that, one, extend the effective date by 1 year to December 31st, 2023, allow for the continued sale, distribution, and use of affected products that are already in commerce in Minnesota as of the effective date of the act, and then also seek for safer alternatives and comparable cost language inclusion, as mentioned by another witness. Food packaging is strictly regulated by the FDA, and substances used in food packaging must complete rigorous review process before they are sold or distributed in the United States. In the recent reassessment by the FDA, manufacturers of the majority of PFAS products used in fiber-based food packaging agreed to voluntarily phase out, leading the discontinuation of sale of these products and the use of food packaging as of January 1st, 2024. As reflected in its announcement of this agreement, FDA concluded that this phase-out period is needed to avoid unnecessary food supply chain and market disruptions. The timeline outlined by the FDA would aid in compliance and implementation with the nation and neighboring states that do not have plans. For these reasons, we respectfully ask for the effective date move, the language for allowing the continued sale after the effective date, and seeking for safer alternatives and comparable cost language. We also submitted testimony that's a little bit more detailed with scientific research, and happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swearingen. That's all for public testimony today. We will move to member discussion and questions. Members, any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill author, I appreciate the work that you're endeavoring to do here, Representative Wozlik. And would ask that you take into account the considerations of the concerns that people have brought forward here. I don't think that anybody was speaking opposed to the idea today. They're just looking at the implementation timeline to make sure they can be effectively done and dealing with some of the other issues. So that is my hope, that you would be able to and be open to those suggestions and those ideas as we move forward. Thank you.
Representative Wozlik, you care to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. We are headed back to environment, and so we will have the opportunity to make some changes. We've had conversations with MPCA and others about enforcement language and a few other tweaks, so there is the opportunity for that, and certainly open to those conversations and discussions. So thank you for reading that.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair, and to Representative Wozlik. Thanks for bringing this bill forward, and I appreciate all the work that you've done on this issue. I would like to support this. I just wanted to go on record. Today I will be voting no, but I really encourage you to continue your work. And as Representative O'Driscoll said, those are my similar thoughts. Just want you to continue to address some of the concerns that the various stakeholders have brought forward, because I think if we can work on those, you'll have a very strong bill in the end. But to that end, I wanted to ask you if you wanted to address why the packaging restrictions in your bill are written so broadly, and maybe give us some more insight on are you open to some of the suggestions on changing that? Thank you.
Representative Wozlik.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Haley, for the question. So the reason that the language is very broad is because there is it applies to a broad range of packaging because the packaging ends up in the waste stream. So there was that graphic that I referred to earlier in member packets that shows that this food packaging isn't just touching the food. The food packaging, the broader food packaging, is also getting into the waste stream. And then it's ending up in landfills and compost sites, and then getting into the groundwater, which is impacting drinking water supply. So it's that's the bigger issue around why we have this broader language, because we know that it doesn't just affect the food that it's touching. This sort of material that has PFAS on it also gets into the environment. And there's a cycle where it goes from the environment to or it can get into drinking water and get into the human body and have those negative health impacts. I'll also point out, as Mr. Carnival said, and I've had conversations with cities and counties as well, is that we're trying to work more upstream on this and prevent it from getting into the environment in the first place, because we know that once it gets there, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to clean up really well. And we're finding it in our wastewater treatment plants, and we're finding it in our landfills and our compost sites, and it's making it difficult for them to sort of do what they need to do. And in further conversations about how we clean up this chemical in the environment, you know, cities and counties and all of us, I think, would prefer that we prevent it from getting into the environment in the first place. And so this broader language is an attempt to prevent those materials from getting into the environment and then moving their way down the cycle to these other places where they stay.
Representative Haley, any follow-up?
Yes, if I may. Thank you, Representative Wasilek. I really appreciate that information. Based on what you said, do we have science that tells us how much of our exposure to these chemicals come from packaging or versus come from our drinking water or source water when you were talking about it getting into the groundwater and the water tables?
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Haley. I don't have like a specific number or percentage off the top of my head, but I have had conversations with people who work who have been working on similar legislation. And from what I've heard, there is higher levels that are getting into the environment and getting back to people that way than from direct food contact with the material. So that's anecdotal. I can't speak to certain statistics or numbers. I don't have that information, but I can certainly reach out to folks I've been working with and see if they can get you that information.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further follow-up.
Okay. Members, I see no other hands up at this time. Any further questions for Representative Wasilek or any of the testifiers? Okay, seeing none, Representative Wasilek, I will give you the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing the bill today and for our testifiers for being here to speak about the bill. Appreciate the discussion. And as I said to Representative O'Driscoll, we're going to continue to work on this bill as it makes its way through the process and do what we can to make it work well for everyone involved. Thanks for hearing it. It's a important. Those of us who have been working on PFAS know that it's a really terrible chemical, and we need to do more about it to prevent it from getting both in the environment and the human body, and this bill is one way to accomplish that. So hope for your support. Thank you.
Well, hearing no further discussion, I will move that House File 79 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy, and I will renew that motion now. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson. Vice Chair Katiza Watun.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative
Stevenson votes aye.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, yes.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee. Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
And Representative Lee.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 79 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy. Next up, we have House File 1269. I will move that House File 1269 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Wasilek, we also have an author's amendment labeled A1. I will move that A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like the committee to consider today. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, if I can just briefly describe where we really came up with that language.
Representative Wasilek.
Members, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the amendment is not super complex, but it was made based on some feedback that I got from the folks who have been working on this language when it was part of the as part of the governor's executive order. So that's just want to be clear there. We had worked with a number of folks to make sure that this amendment was addressing the concerns that they raised to me.
Thank you, Representative Wasilek. Members, any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Wasilek, please go ahead and describe your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1269 as amended protects Minnesotans who receive stimulus payments appropriated by Congress against garnishment of that relief. When Congress appropriated the first round of stimulus payments under the CARES Act, a bipartisan set of senators made clear that these payments were not intended to be seized. U.S. Senators Sherrod Brown and Joss Hawley, in a letter to the Treasury Secretary, noted the stimulus payments that Congress passed were intended to help Americans in need, not to be diverted to debt collectors. Without protection from seizure, the story of a Minnesota family reported in the New York Times last April might happen again. In that case, a disabled veteran and his spouse lost 100% of their stimulus payments. In that story, the couple said they were counting on that payment to help pay rent and buy baby formula for their 10-month-old daughter. Not only are people like those in this newspaper story at risk, but so are many Minnesota seniors who, according to the National Council on Aging, more and more of them are carrying a debt burden from medical debt. Without this protection, their stimulus payments could be suspended. I would note that the bill does provide an exception for child support and health maintenance payments. In sum, while people need to pay the debts they owe, it's important to recognize that during this pandemic and its disproportionate financial and health impacts on lower income Minnesotans and communities of color, these federal stimulus payments really need to go where they're intended to help folks weather the storm and get through the pandemic until things get back to a little more normal. So with that, I would welcome your support of House File 1269. And I know that we have a couple of testifiers here as well.
Thank you, Representative Wasilek. We do have two testifiers signed up to speak today. First off, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Mr. Elwood, are you with us? Please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And I also have with me, if there are any technical questions, my colleague from Legal Aid, Beth Goodell, who is our supervising attorney or our consumer unit. And I also see Mr. Carlson on the Zoom call, and I know he's expert as well. I just want to say that I really appreciate Representative Wasilek bringing this bill before the committee today. We had worked on this bill, this concept with Mr. Carlson and others in the industry to come to an agreement long before this that the stimulus payments should absolutely go to the folks and not be diverted in any way. I can just say that from Legal Aid standpoint, many of our clients are struggling during the pandemic, and this bill would make sure that the necessary payments that are coming, hopefully in the next round of stimulus, will go for the basic needs that they need to keep afloat until the economy recovers. So with that, I'll just say again, thank you very much and happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Next on the list, I have Joel Carlson. Mr. Carlson, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent a group called the Minnesota Creditors Rights Association, which is a collection of about 170 lawyers in Minnesota that represent creditors in our Minnesota state courts. When the pandemic started in March, not just in Minnesota, but across the country, many of the lawyers that represent creditors move to exempt any stimulus payments that are needed for family needs during the pandemic from any type of garnishment. We communicated that both to Legal Aid and to the governor's office. It's been the subject of an executive order. I don't believe a single stimulus check was ever subject to garnishment in Minnesota, and we support that, and we support the bill, and we appreciate the legislature taking some of these issues on that have been the subject of executive orders so that you know what's going on. You know, this has been in place since May 4th of 2020, and I think it's something the legislature should know about and should be aware of and address. So we appreciate you bringing the bill forward, and it has our support as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. That's all for testifiers that we have signed up for today, so we'll move to member discussion. I see Representative Haley, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, thank you, Representative Wasilewicz, for the bill, and I'm just really pleased to see your attention to this issue. It's not really a question for the bill author, but just a statement for all of us on the committee. You know, this bill is allowing, as the previous testifier said, allowing the legislature to review an important issue that has come about due to COVID, and allows us a chance to weigh in on it and to take public testimony like we did today, and then to pass something along if members agree and take a vote on the House floor, which is chiefly what our job is. And I just wanted to make that point that I think we should be doing that with all the issues that have come up during this pandemic, and not allowing things to be decided just via executive orders. So I'm pleased to see this from the majority party, and would hope that we could see this with all the issues that we've been dealing with COVID-19. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Members, any further discussion? Very well. Representative Wasilewicz, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to reiterate, you know, some of the comments that my testifiers made. This is an important piece that we can take to help folks weather the pandemic. The stimulus payments were directed towards folks who needed that help, and we want to make sure that they're able to retain those payments and use them for what they're intended for. So thanks for the good discussion, and please support the bill.
All right. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 1269, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson. Vice Chair Kachiza-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
In 2019 alone, and in the U.S.,
no.
113.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
I'm sorry, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice. Chair Stevenson. Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
There being 13 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1269, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. You're on your way, Representative Wasilewicz. Thank you. Next, we have House File 1205. I will move House File 1205 be laid over for further consideration. Representative Agbaje, please describe your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. Today, I am presenting House File 1205. The bill addresses certain provisions within the storage lien statute in an effort to update it in a manner to better protect Minnesota consumers. The law was developed in 1988 and was updated in 2014, but some of those updates neglected to include important consumer protections for storage unit customers. The purpose of the bill is to address and include those protections in the law. It updates the dollar value cap on critical personal items that a property owner is entitled by law to retrieve, The current per item cap is $50, which was set in 1988 and has not kept up with inflation. The bill seeks to increase the cap to $150 and then require the Department of Commerce to update it regularly based on CPI. The bill provides that in addition to the property owner and owner's authorized representative is also eligible to access and retrieve items from the storage unit. The bill clarifies the type of materials that can be retrieved. Under the current statute, a storage facility can satisfy a lien against the property owner by selling the occupant's property stored in the unit 45 days after default. If not every item in the unit is sold, the bill includes a provision that would allow a property owner an additional 10 days to retrieve any remaining items after a sale, so that's not simply thrown away. Finally, the bill removes the reference to use residential landlord-tenant eviction law as a remedy when there is a default in the contract agreement between the storage facility and the property owner. That is not the appropriate remedy for such a contract dispute. The motion today is to lay the bill over, as I have recently heard from the self-storage industry advocates about their concerns regarding the bill. We believe that these can be addressed and would like the opportunity to find that compromise and then present an updated bill to the committee. I have with me today Mr. Elwood from Legal Aid, and he's here to provide any additional comments and, of course, answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Mr. Elwood, welcome back. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Elwood, again, from Legal Aid, and again, like to thank Representative Agbaje for bringing this bill. We've been involved in these storage issues for quite some time. There's been some of the legislators I know who've been on this committee a long time have heard these bills. And as you recall, and it's, just to reiterate, the storage lien law is in place since 1988. It was kind of a sleepy little law. And then in 2014, a complete overhaul was done, but some things were left behind. And this is really important because this is the kinds of things that people can, even if they're delinquent, they can still get into the unit to get tools of the trade, critical items of clothing, papers, and things like that. And all this does is update that provision to be in line with what was modernized several years ago. Happy to answer any questions, and thanks again. Hope you can support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. We will now move to member questions and discussion. Representative Lucero.
Thank you. I was actually going to try and get my earbuds in, but it looks like there's not enough time. So hopefully my audio is coming through okay. The question for the Madam Chair and for the bill author is, right now the limit is currently $50 for an item or up to that somebody can retrieve if it falls into those categories. And you want to increase it to $150 and then obviously inflation beyond that. So I'm curious, and I don't have an example offhand, but let's just say it's a paint sprayer or something that's of those categories that isn't immediately readily apparent what the value is, but it might be approaching the $150 and there might be a dispute where somebody could say, the landlord might say, hey, that's $160 of value, or presently, I should say, $60 of value, but the owner is saying it's $40 of value. What happens in cases where there might be a dispute of the value?
Sorry about that. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Again, I mean, with these various contract negotiations, the unit owner and who owns the property and the storage facility, you know, they would have to figure out what that space was and determine the amount per items that they were retrieving. I imagine they could probably look at kind of what the current value is in the marketplace for such an item, or maybe use the amount that was paid for the item when the item was originally retrieved. But if Mr. Elwood has anything to add, I'll let him add. But I think that that's something that could be negotiated between the parties.
Mr. Elwood, any comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lucero. I would just point out that there was a $50 cap, and it's been in place since 1988. And the same question you could have asked for the last 33 years. And, you know, these are the kinds of things the storage facility owner and the occupant of the unit, you know, have had these situations for 33 years. And they're, we've been talking to storage industry folks, and they have not ever said that there is a problem in that determining that. So I guess the answer really is that the parties work it out, and if there's a dispute, I suppose they would be a judicial remedy if they show the receipt for the item, or, you know, but it doesn't seem to have been a problem for 33 years, and it doesn't, we would hope that it wouldn't be a problem for the next 33.
Representative Lucero, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I didn't mean to suggest that there was a problem or anything like that, but in my mind as I'm thinking, here's a tenant, here's a landlord. I presume that the when a tenant goes to retrieve items, that the landlord is probably there, maybe looking over the shoulder, standing to unlock it, to maybe monitor of some kind. Again, I don't know what the process might be. But then if there is a dispute, what happens right there? Does the landlord have the ability to stop? You're not going to take it until we go through the judicial process to resolve our dispute, or is the item taken and then it would have to be resolved after the fact, right? That was more kind of where I was leading. But where I see there, whereas there may not have been a problem in the last 33 years, by upping it to $150, you're now increasing the what would be in scope in terms of property that could be eligible to have that dispute. So we might, whereas today, with $50 of value, there may not be an issue, but by increasing it with more items that are in scope, there might be an issue. So that's where I was kind of leading, is just how would that, what does it look like when the rubber meets the road? So thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Elwood, any response to that?
Well, Representative Lucero, I see that Mr. Daugherty has put his screen on, and he is a representative. We've been talking to him. And he probably would be in a better position to respond to this question.
Mr. Daugherty.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. It's nice to be here this afternoon. My name is Joe Daugherty. I'm with the Self-Storage Association, of the Minnesota Self-Storage Association and the National Self-Storage Association. We submitted a letter regarding this bill, and that outlines our concerns. We do support the motion to lay over so we can have conversations with the sponsor and with Mr. Elwood. To respond directly to Representative Lucero's question, in practice, this component of the law is not used frequently. Our concern is with it more generally, that it does allow people who have not paid their bill to essentially get rent for free. We do outline that in the letter. Our hope is that through conversations with Mr. Elwood and the sponsor, that we can come to some sort of agreement, or you know, maybe just agree to disagree on this bill. You know, we're not particularly concerned that this is going to lead to additional disputes. It's more just generally that this bill does allow people who are not paying to have rent for free. And we believe the law as written now is one of the most consumer-friendly laws in this area in the country, and we believe it's sufficiently protective of Minnesota consumers.
Thank you, Mr. Daugherty, for that feedback. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, and I appreciate the indulgence, Madam Chair. And just one quick follow-up then, just a comment, not a question. And that is, and I share that concern. As a landlord myself, obviously not self-storage, but of real estate, it is a concern for me, putting myself in the shoes of the landlords of the self-storage, that if I have a tenant who is not paid for whatever reason, and they are they have been evicted, and one of the remedies available to me then is in order to recover the amount of lost revenue from somebody who hasn't paid, is to sell off and auction those items by increasing the cap of what they're allowed to take out. We're tripling it, right, from 50 to 150. That create, and then it's going to be inflation beyond that. That creates a scenario where it makes it more difficult then for the private property owner, where the contract has been broken, in order to be made whole. So I have a huge concern with that. And as was mentioned, that Minnesota is one of the, and I'm not aware of that, because I'm not in this space at all, but I take him at his word that, we are one of the more consumer-friendly states in the country, because I am familiar and have watched a show called Storage Wars. I don't know if anybody's ever seen that before, but actually it's a pretty interesting show. And, it, you know, I think it's Texas, California, and New York are the three locations that I've seen. But it's exactly that. It's the landlords and selling off the items in order to recover and be made whole. So, I putting myself in the shoes of the landlords, and I can appreciate and understand the concern whereby the remedy available to them to be made whole. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And I think I might have heard another job in that comment. So I think somebody's keeping track. Representative Agbaje, would you like to respond to any of that testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I would just say that generally what we are trying to do here is ensure that consumers have the full value of their property items, which they are the original property owner of those items, and also trying to work out ways that we can continue to resolve various issues with the liens between the storage unit facility and the property owner. So I thank you for your comments and your consideration. You know, at the same time, I think we should also be considering the consumers as well as we come to a compromise and solution.
Right. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author. Representative Lucero hit on many of the things I was concerned about, and I just want to underscore, I think, the need to be able to deal with those. I think everybody wants to make sure both parties' rights are equally and fairly protected in here. As we move to make some changes, Mr. Elwood and I have worked very successfully on another consumer advocacy kinds of things. And so I would encourage you to continue to work with all stakeholders to get to a spot where this works for everyone. Time does have the inflationary effect. Mr. Elwood probably has more experience with the idea, if there is a dispute, as Representative Lucero asserted, how that gets adjudicated. I'm wondering if we would actually end up in court over something that is it worth $45 or is it worth $65? Because if we have the money for legal fees, we have the money to pay for storage fees and other kinds of things. So I encourage you to continue to work. It seems like this is kind of the teeter-totter point on this that either makes or breaks this legislation for a number of members on our committee, at least on our side of the equation, to make sure that both are evenly represented. So with that, I know it's going to be laid over. I look forward to seeing what the final language is before we commit one way or the other. Thank you again, Representative.
I muted myself instead of unmuting myself. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Yes, as I stated earlier in the presentation, we are definitely very much willing to work with the Self-Storage Association and have already been in conversation. And so hopefully that those will be fruitful and that we can present something much more that protects, you know, both the storage facilities as well as the consumers.
Members, any further discussion on House File 1205? Seeing none, Representative Agbaje, do you have any further comments, any closing comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair, and to committee members. We look forward to coming back to you again. And in the meantime, we hope that you will consider this legislation as it now looks to with a goal of protecting consumers and also bringing this statute up to 2021 from the past 30-something years. So thank you.
Very good. Hearing no further discussion, members, I will renew my motion to lay over House File 1205 for further consideration. The bill is laid over. I, at this point, am going to hand the gavel off to Representative Cagle. We can't hear you, Representative Cagle. Yes, I think so.
Okay. Sorry, my earbuds died, so I had to go back into the wired ones. So played musical chairs today. So up next, we have House File 1292. Representative Katiza Witun, would you like to move your bill?
I will move that House File 1292 be recommended to be placed on the general register. I do have an author's amendment.
It looks like we also...
Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to move the A1. I would like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like the committee to consider today.
Madam Chair, I think we've got a short delay. I don't know who, it might be your delay, Representative Cagle, but there's a short, it sounds like there's a short overlap between when you speak and when we hear it.
Well, I was going to let very, very, very capable Representative Cagle continue throughout the bill, but since she's having some technical difficulties, maybe I'll pop in if that's okay. Representative Cagle, does that sound? I don't think we can hear you, but if you want to, okay, good. I think we have, so we have the A1. Representative Katiza Witun, if you wanted to briefly describe the A1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A1 amendment is just based on further input from the department and just kind of makes a technical clarification.
Great. Any discussion to the A1? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Katiza Witun, if you could describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So members, House File 1292 is a proposal for an enforcement mechanism for the Commerce Department in the area of toxic toys. This proposal goes hand in hand with the Safe Toys Act and three other statutory bans. As a new parent, it's often overwhelming, the sheer number of recommendations that float around both online and in so-called old wives' tales about how best to care for a newborn and then a child as they grow. Advice from physicians or early childhood educators often provides much more of a path to run on, but there is no shortage of things to be concerned about while raising children and wanting to do so to the best of our ability. This can range from the safety of cribs to sleep training, the ever-present breastfeeding or formula debate, and the concerning presence of toxic chemicals in baby bottles or children's toys. In short, parents or caregivers don't often know what we don't know, and this can impact parents all across the socioeconomic and geographic factors. But there is more of a concern that lower-priced generic goods may have a higher concentration of certain toxic chemicals. Here at the legislature, we can assist in minimizing some of these issues. While Commissioner Arnold will address more of the details, one of the main problems faced by the Commerce Department currently is that because of lack of clear authority, the testing of products by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has been limited to those types of products that we have clear authority over. So when products are questioned regarding their levels of BPA or formaldehyde, they often go untested. The MPCA is not investing in the testing of potentially harmful products, such as those that may contain BPA or formaldehyde, because they don't have the Commerce doesn't have the existing authority to do anything about that. So with broader authority that this bill will provide, the MPCA, the Department of Health, and Commerce can work together and get products off the shelves that are harmful to children. One example of this is a calming lavender scented baby shampoo that had been purchased at a low cost or dollar store, Dollar Tree, those sorts of retailer locations. And the product was brought to Commerce. After testing, it was found to have high levels of formaldehyde that were far outside the range allowed under statute. The department didn't have the authority to require the product to be removed from the shelves. And in discussions, luckily in this case, the manufacturer agreed to change the formulary, although because there is no existing authority, Commerce has not been able to confirm whether or not this action was taken. So that's just sort of one of the issues that have popped up, and we are looking to add this enforcement mechanism so that the Commerce Department and others can kind of work together to make sure that any products that have these concerning and toxic chemicals are taken off the shelf. So I do did mention that I have Commerce Department Commissioner Arnold here to testify to the bill today.
And it's always great when Commerce Commissioner Grace Arnold joins us. Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Katiza Witun and members. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold. I'm the temporary commissioner of the Department of Commerce. So I'd like to start by thanking you, Representative Cutizzo-Vatune, for authoring this important proposal. Minnesota has enacted several laws over the years that ban unsafe children's products and restrict and regulate toxic chemicals in children's products. As Representative Cutizzo-Vatune mentioned, these fall under the Safe Toys Act. That act, hazardous toys are banned under Minnesota statute, as well as bans on lead, cadmium, BPA, formaldehyde, and certain flame retardants. To enforce these laws and encourage compliance, the Department of Commerce, along with our partners at the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency, established the Chemicals in Products Interagency Team, which naturally has an acronym, which is CPIT. So through CPIT, our agencies work collaboratively to respond to referrals and concerns about products that are potentially toxic to children. When a product is identified as being unsafe or potentially containing banned chemicals, MPCA and MDH jointly have the products tested for compliance. And then if the product is found to be out of compliance, then the department that is referred to the department, and then we can take action. We work with manufacturers, distributors, and retailers to get the products off shelves and issue recalls when necessary. This coordination between agencies has already proven to protect children through our efforts. In addition to the example from before, you may recall during the holiday shopping season in 2019, the department issued a ban on off-brand spinning battle toys after a Minnesota child got sick. The toy had metal parts that flaked off dust and was determined to be the cause, and it had high levels of lead and cadmium. If you're aware of these, they naturally flake off in the course of utilizing the toy. Breathing in and swallowing lead or cadmium can cause serious health problems and even death, especially in babies and children under six or pregnant women. So through the CPIT, the toxic toys were detected, and we were able to have the toys pulled from the shelves both locally and nationally from retailers such as Amazon and other online retailers. Additional testing and investigations through CPIT have led to nationwide recalls of unsafe products such as children's jewelry containing high levels of cadmium. Unfortunately, when three of the statutory bans were created, there was an oversight, so there's no enforcement authority for the department. So that includes crib safety, BPA, and formaldehyde. Testing of these products by MPCA, as Representative Cutizzo-Vatune has noted, has been limited, and so they often go untested. Because there's no authority, then no state agency can take action. House File 1292 provides these three statutes with the same oversight authority that exists for the other chemicals that I mentioned at the beginning of my comments. And that allows the agencies in the CPIT to the authority to test and then address these potentially hazardous products. It will also help provide clarity for manufacturers, distributors, and retailers regarding the extent to which the Safe Toys Act applies to crib safety, BPA, and formaldehyde. So I'll close by saying, you know, most often when you hear someone, a parent who's had a situation like this, the thing that they want is to have the next kid not have something happen to them. And the lack of authority really prevents us from giving that parent the satisfaction that something else isn't going to happen to another kid. So I'll end by thanking Representative Cutizzo-Vatune for bringing forward the proposal and giving us the opportunity to highlight the department's efforts to protect Minnesota consumers. I'm joined by my colleague, Jackie Olson, and others from MDH who can we can all kind of tag team to answer questions. So Chair Stevenson, thank you again, and members, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Arnold. There are no further testifiers who signed up, so we'll move on to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Commissioner, for being here with us today. Just a quick question, if I could, to the Commissioner, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
Madam Commissioner, this is going to the General Register, and there's no fiscal note with this. Are you, is the department planning to assume the costs associated with enforcement within their current enforcement budget?
Commissioner Arnold.
Representative Stevenson, or Chair Stevenson, Representative Adjustable, gotten out of practice. It's been like 3 days. so that's correct.
Representative O'Driscoll.
That's all I want to know, because that's usually a question that comes up as far as funding is concerned. So thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have at this time.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Katisa-Watune, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Arnold. This is a good bill. Let's take action and get these products off the shelves to protect the children of Minnesota.
Agreed. Would you like to renew your motion?
I will renew my motion that House File 1292 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
All right. Representative Katisa-Watune renews her motion that House File 1292 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. And Mr. Brown will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Katisa-Watune.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Daphne.
Daphne votes aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee. Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice. Representative Tice.
With 16 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1292, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. We have no further bills on the agenda, but I got a text message while I was in presenting a bill in the Health Committee that perhaps I missed a new job from Representative Lucero. I want to know, what did I miss, Representative Lucero?
Honestly, I don't know why I didn't mention anything. I was... I don't know.
Mr. Chair,
I believe it was landlord.
Landlord. I knew that one. That one wasn't new to me, but maybe it was
new. It was the first time he said it in committee.
Gotcha.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Well, I've got a list of about a dozen left, so we'll see if we can exhaust it by the end of the year.
Only a dozen.
Hopefully I don't run out of room on my sheet.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll?
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if you, since we do have a few minutes, can give us maybe a little bit of a picture of what the landscape looks like now as we're leading up to the halfway point here. We are going to be finishing our ninth week of the session. We do have one or two week and a half, something like that, where we're going to be off with the Easter Passover break, and we're coming up to first deadline. Are you planning Friday committee meetings? What's the future look like so members can plan accordingly?
Absolutely. Appreciate the question, Representative O'Driscoll. I don't expect an additional hearing this week. We are looking at an extra date next week, but that is to be determined and will in part depend upon bill referrals. We're waiting to see what bills come our way. As you are, you know, well aware, this is a hectic time, and it's a little bit up in the air to see when bills actually make it to the Commerce Committee. In particular, I want to note that the revisor's office is working extra hard to process those committee reports remotely, and so there's a little bit of ambiguity there, and appreciate your patience. But we will be doing bill hearings through first deadline. There are some bills that were heard in the Senate and have yet to be heard in the House that we will deal with in the week between first and second deadline. And then we have some exciting hearings planned following second deadline.
Wow, look at that. Must-see TV, it sounds like, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm really
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
you had said that there's probably going to be another meeting, not this week, but next week. Are you assuming that's a Friday meeting? Are you planning an evening meeting?
Representative O'Driscoll, I don't have a day or time for you. I will let the committee know as soon as I do. I don't want to mislead anyone about when that would be. My hope would be later in the week, but really it's up to the speaker's office. And I promise as soon as I have that information, I will provide it to you.
And Mr. Chair, you have been very good to work with on that. I want to say that publicly. You and I have spoken throughout the session about trying to make this process work via remote and from everybody from all different places. So I thank you. And I just wanted to give everybody a chance to hear what you and I talk about, because it's really exciting and riveting stuff. And you can just see they're all just sitting on the edge of their seats to hear more. So
and with that, Mr. Chair, heard that's our, all our seat conversations yet. I mean, really, this is
right.
Has there ever been a pair for better witty banter? I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I before I adjourn, I will just say that I also really appreciate our good working relationship, Representative O'Driscoll, and I'm glad that we've been able to keep it up and look forward to continuing that throughout the rest of the session.
And I will visit with you offline on a couple of other topics, sir.
Sounds great. Thank you. And with that, we'll adjourn the hearing. Thank you.